Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Nick Blumberg. Former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan caps a 50-year political career with 7.5 years in prison and a $2.5 million fine.
At a sentencing hearing this afternoon, a federal judge says Madigan's lies on the stand were a nauseating display of perjury and evasion.
I will stand in the way of Tom Homan going after people who don't deserve to be frightened in their communities, who don't deserve to be threatened, terrorized.
J.B. Pritzker punches back at Republicans in a Capitol Hill hearing on immigration policies that the governor calls a political circus.
I am counting on all of Chicago to resist in this moment, because whatever particular vulnerable group is being targeted today, another group will be next.
After a week of demonstrations in Chicago and around the country against the Trump administration's immigration enforcement, the city prepares for a massive No Kings rally on Saturday. Meanwhile, the Secretary of State's office says out-of-state police illegally accessed local license plate readers in immigration and abortion cases. And city council considers a crackdown on short-term rentals like Airbnb.
We'll be joined by our Week in Review panel in just a moment, but first we go to the Dirksen Federal Courthouse with our reporter Matt Masterson, who is there for Madigan's sentencing today. Matt, what was the scene like at the courthouse?
Yeah, Nick, the 12th floor courtroom of Judge John Blakey was absolutely packed with media, observers, members of Michael Madigan's family. But once the hearing got underway, there were no fireworks, there were no live witnesses. It was mostly just a clinical reading from Blakey of the charges against Madigan, the bribery schemes that he outlined and was convicted of, and the sentences that he faced, ultimately handing him down the 7.5 year, 90-month prison sentence, along with a $2.5 million fine, the maximum allowable under the guidelines. Madigan made some brief statements, but there was no one else who spoke in his favor outside of the hundreds of letters that were turned in before the hearing today.
Yeah, it seemed like it was quite the lengthy proceeding. What did Madigan have to say when he was appealing to the judge, and you know, what was his demeanor like?
Yeah, the hearing lasted about 4 hours. Madigan made some brief comments. He apologized for simply putting the state of Illinois through this, saying he tried his best to represent his constituents as he was a politician, but that he admitted he isn't perfect. What he did not do was admit to any of the specific allegations against him. He never admitted that he accepted bribes in exchange for his trading his public official action. His attorneys actually during the hearing maintained that he is still not guilty of all of these crimes, even the ones he was convicted of. His demeanor was mostly relaxed throughout the hearing. He didn't have any outbursts. He was, as he normally is, very stoic, taking notes. He was smiling and chatting with family and his attorneys. But after the hearing, after the sentence was handed down, it did appear that some realization was coming through of what had just been happened to him, that he's going to be spending 7.5 years in prison.
Well, and Matt, it seemed like Judge Blakey certainly was not pulling his punches. What did he have to say to Madigan before he handed down that sentence?
Yeah, absolutely. Judge Blakey absolutely took issue with Madigan's decision to testify and willfully perjure himself repeatedly. Blakey, as you noted, called this a nauseating display. He called his testimony, which lasted parts of 4 days earlier this year, difficult to watch at parts. He's found that Madigan lied about basically all regards of these schemes. He lied about his efforts to solicit bribes from Commonwealth Edison. He lied about his relationship with his co-defendant, Michael McLean. He lied about his intention to secure a lucrative state board seat for Danny Solis. Blakey went through all of these, and it was very clear that this played a role in the significant sentence that was handed down, not only the prison term, but as I said, for the $2.5 million fine, the maximum allowable. Blakey clearly relied on his issue with the perjury to come to that conclusion.
Well, certainly a remarkable ending to Michael Madigan's career and to a lengthy trial. Matt Masterson, thanks for your coverage. We appreciate it. And now to this evening's panel. Joining us are Chris Jones from the Chicago Tribune, Shruti Singh from Bloomberg News, Francia Garcia Hernandez from Block Club Chicago, and our own Heather Sharon from WTTW News. Heather, it's not the 12.5 years that prosecutors wanted, but nonetheless a pretty stiff sentence for former House Speaker Madigan. Were you surprised by that?
I was surprised because I think the obvious point of comparison is the 2-year sentence that former Alderman Ed Burke received just earlier this year on somewhat similar, although not identical, charges. He also got a $2 million fine. What I think made the difference between the two sentences was Madigan's decision to roll the dice and testify in his own defense that the judge seemed personally offended by. The other thing is that, like Burke, Madigan had hundreds of people write into the judge and say how much he had meant to them, how much he had helped them. Judge Blakey, unlike U.S. District Court Judge Virginia Kendall, did not seem to care about those letters at all. During Burke's sentencing hearing, Judge Kendall went on at length about how moved she was by some of the stories in those letters. And I am truly fascinated by the different approaches that each judge took in those two cases. The other thing I'll say is that Ed Burke, just before he was sentenced, expressed a bit more remorse for what he did than Madigan did today. And perhaps that made the difference. However, if I'm Ed Burke in prison tonight, I am looking at this knowing that I dodged years in prison, and he is due back released in March.
Yeah, the Fifth Amendment exists for a reason.
Indeed.
You know, Chris, federal prosecutors have had some setbacks and some failures recently in their various corruption trials, prosecution efforts. How big of a win is Madigan's conviction, even if partial, and this sentencing?
Well, I think it's a big win, and it's a win for justice in Illinois. But on the other hand, I agree with Heather. That was a bit longer than I thought he was going to get. And I think the business of sentencing octogenarian people is a complicated one. If you think about it, most of us guys don't go on forever past, I mean, if you really, it's a sort of unpleasant math to do, but that you have to sort of say there's a chance that he won't come out of jail alive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something to be sober about. There's a sort of human tragedy at the heart of this. I think federal guidelines, it's what, 85% of the sentence that he has to serve? Mm-hmm. That's a long time. That's rough on him, but it's hard to say that it's unjust. And it's also a picture of the danger of testifying in your own defense when it can be used against you. But I think he generally doesn't feel that he was guilty, and he's a proud man, I think, and he couldn't bring himself to lie again, so to speak, expediently to get a shorter sentence. And so you look at it and you go, well, here's a very elderly guy who is now maybe not going to come home.
Yeah. He's 83 years old, and his wife, Shirley Madigan, they've been married for decades. She is also very ill, and she recorded a video pleading with the judge not to send her husband to jail for a long time, telling him that she did not want to spend her final days alone. And I think that sort of family and human tragedy, we can't look past that. But I think that sometimes in these white-collar cases, people will say, oh, well, it wasn't a violent crime. There weren't any actual victims. I think your point, Chris, is that the people of Illinois were the victim in this case. And will this longer-than-anticipated sentence make other politicians think twice? I think that is the longer-term question.
Well, you know, and to that point, I mean, truth be saying, sometimes there are economic implications for these. I mean, the perception of Illinois is a hotbed of political corruption. You know, when, for example, markets are looking at Illinois, how does that affect things?
So in 2022, I actually asked investors about that very question when this case had started, when the legal proceedings had started. And one of the things that one of the investors said to me is that some of this is baked in, unfortunately, into the perception of Illinois. Now, Illinois has had a few years where they've had credit upgrades. Their financial trajectory has been improving. It's still marginally still the lowest rated state in the country, but their trajectory has been positive and has had several notches up. But when investors are thinking about these, the long history, this, you know, Heather mentioned a couple of cases, and there's been others as well.
It's plenty.
what somebody said to me, one of the investors, was that it's baked in, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a case that we are not going to be done discussing for quite some time. We could probably do the full show on it, but a lot of news this week. I want to get to Governor J.B. Pritzker testifying at a congressional hearing on Illinois and other states' sanctuary status, although he also faced some completely off-topic questions, for example, about transgender Illinoisans. Francia, do you think the governor accomplished what he set out to do in trying to defend his state?
I think his message was loud and clear, defying Trump's tactics regarding immigration raids and protest handling of immigration raids as well. And he also made clear that sanctuary laws are lawful and that he will continue to protect and defend the sanctuary state and counties and city policies that exist. So that was a strong message. He also was very defiant of Trump's authoritarian measures, what he called, and was very defiant against breaking the Constitution, the law, or going about it in terms of enforcing immigration policies.
Yeah, it was certainly a bit of a high wire act for the governor. I mean, Shruthi, this hearing comes as Illinois lawmakers are bracing for perhaps the Trump administration to try and, you know, take back some federal funding. We heard a lot about that in this last legislative session. Could a hearing like this be used as perhaps justification for funding clawbacks?
Governor Pritzker has been warning about the uncertainty about federal funding for months now, even before the budget was passed at the end of last month. Since he's introduced his budget, he has been warning that there could be potential policy changes that put billions of dollars at risk for the state of Illinois, along with other states. The other thing that he's also mentioned is that it's not just Illinois, but that every state would have a challenge if there's any sort of clawback because of policies or any measures, just cuts in general, because the federal government is looking at broader cuts that are not tied specifically to politics, you know, just funding in general.
Sure.
But he has said that any state would have a problem backfilling those billions of dollars.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to make up for by
yeah.
any stretch.
And he's also mentioned that there's a lot of uncertainty still. So
right.
we don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, Francia, you mentioned some of the Trump administration's immigration agenda, enforcements. Several members of the city council want to investigate whether Chicago police aided ICE agents in a mass detention earlier this month. What are older people concerned about there?
There was a heavy police presence at a scene in the South Loop where there is an ICE contractor that monitors immigrants under a monitoring program. ICE agents showed up and were detaining people under check-ins, and CPD was present inside the building and at the front and back of the building. So several city council members are wondering whether that was helping ICE, whether they responded to ICE or a call for local law enforcement from ICE officials, and how those decisions are made when CPD is dispatched to a scene and then they discover that it's in an immigration enforcement operation.
Yeah, and you have to imagine that we may be seeing more of these immigration actions. You know, Chris, Trump has sent the military into Los Angeles amid protests there. The Tribune had an editorial this week headlined that MAGA morphs into Make America Cruel Again. Mm-hmm. What are the worries there about potential presidential overreach?
Well, I think we were concerned about the National Guard and the Marines being sent into American cities, onto American streets. I think our view is that going after the police is not the way to, that those aldermen are not helping the situation there. I think we have to support our police. I think we have to make the case that that when there is any kind of civil unrest, if that happens this weekend in Chicago, that's a matter for the Chicago police. I don't think the Chicago police are trying to enforce immigration laws and deportations. I think the issue is that it's a police issue. It shouldn't be one that requires the imposition of the military on the streets of Chicago. But we were also trying to say that there was a really noticeable cruelty in how these things, a performative element, let's say, mm-hmm. in how these deportations were being carried out. And indeed, in the very assignment of the Marines and the National Guard, that's the guy in charge. That's what he likes to do. And I think that doesn't sit well with us.
Yeah, having someone like Dr. Phil going along
yeah,
on immigration
so
raids,
it's so, there's so much performative nonsense. It's true of the Pritzker hearings, too. I mean, it's just too much, you know, and people have to be treated decently. And I think that Pritzker was right in the congressional hearings to talk about the lack of immigration reform. That's a very good blue state defense mm-hmm. against the Republicans in Congress, saying essentially, it's on you. You didn't get this done when you had the opportunity to do it. Now look, it's chaos for me. That's a good defense. And he was right to say we need to have an immigration enforcement force too, which he also said, which some of his progressive allies, I think, wouldn't agree with.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Heather, to Chris mentioned that massive No Kings rally that's prepped for tomorrow. Time to coincide with a military parade in D.C. for the 250th anniversary of the Army, which happens to coincide with the president's 79th birthday. Just how unusual is that military parade? What do we expect to see there?
So we're going to see rows of troops marching in formation. We're going to see tanks rolling down the boulevards in Washington, D.C. And it is unprecedented, a word I am sorely tired of saying.
For the last 5 years.
That has really a scene that's really never been seen in an American city before and is reminiscent of a scene in communist Russia, North Korea. This is not typically how Americans celebrate our military. And I think that Americans have never before seen this level of weaponry and artillery in a city, and I think a lot of people are very nervous about sort of what this heralds going forward.
Yeah. Well, you know, Francie, some local immigrant advocates have been protesting the president's new travel ban, barring residents from 12 countries, limiting travel from 7 others. What have we heard from the White House about why these bans might be necessary?
Well, the White House put out a fact sheet saying that some of these countries were selected for the bans because people have long visa overstay rates. The countries themselves don't have enough or sufficient vetting processes for visas and other security purposes, and some of them refuse to cooperate with the United States for several matters. So it seems like that is the reason. I have to say it is similar to the first Trump travel ban that we saw during his first term. It's just revived and expanded to a majority of Arab and African countries.
Well, I want to turn to some local news. You know, Shruti, you had a big piece recently looking at some of Chicago's financial woes, things that are kind of baked into the budget. Just how far are economic and job growth lagging behind here, you know, compared to some of our peer cities?
So let me start out with some of the strengths of Chicago.
All right, yes.
And then we'll
I like that spin.
And then we'll go into some of the other numbers. So Chicago is still the economic engine, the economic center of the Midwest. And in terms of the number of STEM students that its universities produce, there's really no comparison, in the Midwest at least. And it is still a center for Fortune 500 companies. So all of that is true and undisputed in terms of facts. But also the growth that it has seen in the decade through, say, 2023 has been lagging other cities, particularly those in the West and the Southwest. And cities such as Phoenix, Houston, San Antonio are seeing greater growth in terms of population, in terms of job growth, GDP growth. Now, they are starting from a smaller base.
Sure.
Chicago still has 2.7 million people. And it actually did see a little bit of a bump up recently. But some of the other cities proportionally saw bigger increases. So what does that mean? So there's questions about if there isn't as much growth in Chicago compared to its peers around the country, what does that mean in terms of business? And so one of the longtime developers that I spoke with that has been developing properties in Chicago since, say, the mid-1980s, he recently has been shifting more of his business over to the Phoenix area. Some of the things he mentioned are population growth isn't as strong. He's concerned about property taxes, which I know Heather's also written about quite a bit.
Once
or twice. So these aren't surprising, but what is happening is that there is a greater competition amongst cities in the U.S. and even internationally in terms of looking for people, looking for jobs, employers, as well as investments. So when you're putting a lot of money into things like pensions, which are a cost that the city does have to pay, or debt, for example, then those are dollars that cannot be then put into economic development. And that therein lies the question. One of the CEOs I spoke with that is still here in Chicago and, you know, has a very large population of employees in this region has said the focus should be more on growth and not as much on the cost side of the ledger.
Well, there are certainly plenty of challenges for us to address. But yes, thank you. We've still got a lot going for us, and we like it here. Heather, older people are considering tighter restrictions on short-term rentals, things like Airbnb and Vrbo. What are they looking at there?
Well, since home sharing came to Chicago all the way back in 2016, it has been a perpetual problem that people will rent these houses or apartments and throw giant parties that create a neighborhood nuisance. And older people are fed up about it. They They've tried a couple of times, most recently as last month, to sort of rein in those parties. Many feel like they haven't been successful, so they want to expand their favorite power, aldermanic power, to basically give each alderperson the chance to say in each precinct that new short-term rentals are banned. Now, if somebody wants to reopen that precinct to short-term rentals, they can go and petition everybody, all of the voters in that precinct, and if they collect 10%, then it would be reopened. But this would be a large expansion of aldermanic power to sort of rein in these short-term rentals. Airbnb is vehemently opposed to this. They say they are good corporate citizens and that this would basically be swatting a fly with a hammer. It is set for a vote on Wednesday. However, there are a lot of questions about what this will mean to the city's budget, because these short-term rentals bring in millions of dollars, and they are specifically used to fund two parts of the budget: domestic violence services and services for unhoused Chicagoans. You take away the ability for new short-term rentals, you're going to restrict the growth of that, of those budget items. And I think Shruti and I would probably agree that that's something that the city should probably think twice about before doing.
And the kind of thing that you can easily see going on, say, an attack mailer of alderperson so-and-so voted to cut funding for domestic violence. I mean, you know, Chris, what do you make of the motivation behind this crackdown? I mean, is this really that big of a problem?
No.
Okay, great. Next question.
We had an editorial saying, leave it alone. It's all fine. We're not Venice. We're not Dubrovnik. We don't have, you know, building after building filled with Airbnbs. And hoteliers are often behind these kinds of things because they like to raise rates. And Airbnb provides competition. And this was a big issue in New York City, where they insisted that hosts actually remain in the apartments when their Airbnb people were there. So, of course, everybody stopped renting their Airbnbs. Hotel rates went through the roof. As anybody who goes to New York knows how expensive it is. And as Heather points out, there's a lot of city income from all of that. And if there is bad behavior going on, well, then you address it. People have parties in houses, too, where they live. So, you know, I think on balance, there's already restrictions, and individual buildings can already restrict Airbnbs. I think the idea of just sort of banning them all by fear. And let's remember, too, that there's small businesses. So when people stay in an Airbnb in, let's say, Wrigleyville, because they want to be close to a Cubs game, they go down and they spend money in the restaurants. They, you know, they buy stuff in the stores. They buy a T-shirt. And families don't like hotel rooms because the kids are everywhere.
Right.
So you want an apartment. I stayed in one in Boston just a couple of weeks ago. So I loved it. It was great. It was an Airbnb. It was way better than a hotel room. So I think, you know, come on. We got other things to worry about. That's
just one or two. Minor details. Well, I want to mention, too, Chris, you know, Senate President Don Harmon was pushing a measure this past legislative session that would have gotten his campaign fund off the hook for some alleged violations that the Trib editorial board called sly. And I don't think it was complimentary. What was he trying to do there?
Well, I think he was just trying to make things work for himself, because he already had this sort of, he'd done this sort of egregious thing. And then he was kind of, it was kind of a post facto manipulation of what was going on. It didn't fly in the legislature, so we were pleased about that. But we thought it was kind of sneaky. Good try, but pretty sneaky.
Well, you know, that legislators got to take a swing at things sometimes. We've got about a minute left. You know, Heather, Northwestern University emailed faculty and staff about cost-cutting measures following the Trump administration's move to freeze about $790 million in federal funding. The university's got a $14 billion endowment. Do you think we'll see them use any of that to plug the gap, or are they leaving it put?
Well, they would. There are certainly professors and staffers and students who would like to see them sort of dip into that endowment and use it as sort of a rainy day fund to get the university through this sort of period of uncertainty. You know, university financing is only just as complicated as city financing. I do not profess to be an expert on it, but this is something that universities across the nation are grappling with it. Harvard, you know, all of the Ivy Leagues, Columbia in particular, and, you know, there are a lot of university presidents are going to have to make a lot of hard decisions, and the people who will feel the brunt of that will, of course, be the faculty and the staff.
All right. Well, hopefully nobody here was feeling the brunt of anything too bad. You were a great panel, but we are out of time. So our thanks to Chris Jones, Shruti Singh, Francie Garcia Hernandez, and Heather Sharone. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family. the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
Before we go tonight, we'd like to ask for your help. You may have heard that Congress voted to cut current and future funding to PBS. That legislation now goes to the Senate. We're here to ask you to consider two things: making a contribution to WTTW and letting your voice supporting public media be heard. You can learn the facts at WTTW.com/protectmypublicmedia and share those facts with your family and friends. And if it's right for you, you can donate to WTTW by calling 773-588-1111, going to WTTW.com, or scanning the QR code on your screen. Your contribution at whatever level you choose is always appreciated, but what's most important is that you participate. This is public media, and it's our members that keep us strong today and into the future. And that's our show for this Friday night. For the Week in Review, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay informed. Have a great weekend. Okay, I think maybe my favorite headline I saw this week: Chicago man wears White Sox cap to work. That man, of course, is Pope Leo. I guess the odds of getting him out of his vestments and into a jersey are probably pretty slim, but does it feel like the Pope is from Chicago boom is still going strong?
It's still going strong. And I could not resist making a snarky post on social media because, of course, the Cubs claimed that he was a Cubs fan when it turns out he was a Sox fan. Important to check your facts before you post.
And as much as I would have loved for him to be a Cubs fan, it just didn't work out that way.
Yeah.
They need a team of journalists who are verifying things before they put it up on the big marquee there.
Yeah.
But I'd be interested to see. I mean, the Pope, they've got a big mass at you know, at Sox Park tomorrow, and expecting to hear a video address.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.